This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Kate, we have a reader question.
Love a reader question.
It's got a bit of a, not a super long intro, but I'm going to read it anyway. Thanks for such a wonderful podcast. I really enjoy listening to your lovely voices and learning about the nuts and bolts of writing. Sometimes it seems that the ideas are the easy parts. It's getting them out of my head that's the tricky part. What with juggling work, family, and a small farm, not to mention anxiety. It's understandably a lot of balls.
That is a lot of things, including the farm. That I feel like
the farm. Exactly.
Carry on.
I have a question I hope you can help me with. Do the majority of authors you cross paths with study writing in a formal sense through tertiary courses? Can one hone their skills through lots and lots of reading and practice, as well as educating themselves through various books, podcasts, seminars, workshops, etc., on a more ad hoc basis as time and finances allow? Please keep up the inspiring work and many thanks for considering my question. Good luck with all your writing endeavours.
That's lovely.
Really nice.
I love getting emails from people. Keep sending them, please.
I feel like we have to confess, we're not as good at replying to the emails.
We're not. We're sorry.
We do another blanket apology. Oh, it's such an awful thing that we are not on top of that.
I know. But we eventually get to them, I promise.
Do we?
Yes, I'm sure we do.
I think there's some in my mind that are still sticking in there that I'm like, we haven't responded.
Okay, all right. We'll get there. I promise we'll get there. You're right. I'm actually just writing down a couple of emails I know we haven't sent.
Okay, so this is absolutely not a criticism, but I feel like we have talked about study a bit. So, Kate, 25 words or less, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that this person has answered their own question in a way. You absolutely do not need to study. There are a bazillion resources, and I love that idea that you can hone your skills through, especially through reading. This is not 25 words or less. I apologize. Having said all that, I would not have been published without RMIT. So yeah. I think that the accountability, the expectation of writing words, and the network, as well as having someone open up your reading and writing ideas, which I think sometimes you can fall into that same silo if you're just searching for your own stuff according to what you like. In terms of what other writers do, I think it's really split. I do think it's really split.
There's a special type of snowflake that doesn't need to study, like a writer that's naturally gifted. I know I'm not that person. And I'd say the only person that I know that is like that is Michelle Wright, who you know as well, the author of Fine, which is a short story collection that came out a couple of years ago. She, I remember, I think she did a course with Tony Jordan, and Tony Jordan said to her, don't ever study, it'll ruin you. The most beautiful writer. But I think for most people it helps. The thing I would say is I feel like TAFE is where it's at instead of university for creative writing.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
All right. Moving along. I think we had a few other things to talk about, but given we are still in lockdown, this is the last day of week 3. Can't really see us coming out in 3 weeks, can you?
I can't. Can I tell you what bliss it was to not be checking the numbers while I was in the Word Cave? Because we weren't allowed to. The idea is that you don't check social media or look at news. And every day, like, I could feel this little kind of flutter in my chest come 11 o'clock when I was usually waiting for the presser. But I didn't check. So I didn't know what was coming.
I think I'm falling in love with, what's his name? Brett Sutton, the chief health officer.
So what's one of my friends?
He's become quite handsome.
Shay Gardner, I'm looking at you. She has shared that photo of the young Brett Sutton.
I didn't even look.
Oh, my gosh. All right. I'm sending it to you. You can make it your.
Oh, God. This is like the low point of the pandemic. We are sharing photos of the chief health officer.
Well, this is the small things which we are reduced to. So tell me, you wanted us to have a bit of a pity party.
I did want a pity party. So obviously we're very lucky in the scheme of things. We are lucky in the world anyway. White women, we're living in houses. Australia's doing really well. Having said that, what really trivial things would you like to complain about that you really shouldn't be complaining about given everything else that's going on in the world? And I think the best example of this that I've seen is someone I know posted on Twitter, on Facebook, saying they were given a massage voucher for Christmas. The massage voucher has now expired and they have not had a chance to use it. I feel like that is both understandable and suitably trivial.
Great. I love it. I love it. And I feel like we hit 80 episodes this week, and I feel like maybe we've been leading to this, like we've built up this audience just so we could have this whinge when we needed it. So here's a couple of my things.
We'll trade back and forth. I reckon we'll go back and forth.
Okay. So let's go back and forth. So I don't know what online platform your school is using for your children, but we're using WebEx, and I do not know why you have to click so many things so many times to get into that damn meeting.
I would be more sympathetic, but we're not using WebEx. We're using something equally useless. My first one is we are still drinking powdered milk. Still.
And you have to stop.
Oh my God. Occasionally I, like if I have to fill up the car with petrol, I'll go to Shell and get a soda stream refill, and because you have to spend $20 there anyway, get a soda stream refill and a luxury milk. And it feels pretty good, let me tell you.
I feel like we should mark not only the end of lockdown, but the end of powdered milk for you, that will be a real
line. And we drink a lot of milk. Each packet makes 9 litres of milk. This gives you some insight into the, I think Carney had some residual anxiety from the fires, which was expressed.
Sort of expressed by the milk. I see how that could happen. I obviously, like everyone, I miss my friends, particularly hugging them, but I think I miss strangers as well.
Really?
I have this feeling. Like just I miss being kind of shuffled around in a crowded room or on the train. I miss that. Is that weird?
I do not miss that.
Okay. All right. Another thing.
Wow. But there's, I guess the beauty of strangers is anonymity as well, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
it's just that you're a part of the world.
Yeah. And who knows, maybe we'll never be allowed to do that again. So maybe I'm just looking through rose tinted glasses at a bygone time. Okay. Next.
The fact that I'm expected to work, just would prefer not to.
Yeah. I like that.
Grateful for the paycheck.
Yeah.
Really not that interested in the work.
Yeah. It takes a different kind of, there's a different shine to it when you don't get
to work. Is really, really pulling out all stops to, in a really nice way, to sort of boost morale. And I think I mentioned the virtual women's circles.
Yes, you did.
I did another one recently. It was one of those things I should have just opted out from the very beginning, but just kind of went along with it. They organized like kitchen coffee catch-ups that were just designed to simulate that idea of you go in to the kitchen to fill up your cup of coffee and some random people are in there, which is not a situation anyone ever wants to recreate. So it was just a different random assortment of people and put you in a like a 15-minute Zoom meeting together.
Did you have to pretend you were making a coffee?
Like, no, you didn't have to. You were allowed. Well, that's right. What did you talk about? Just someone's dog.
That's so funny. I love workplaces and not being in one. I miss libraries. Because I'm a big nerd and I miss the big ones and the university ones that I keep on finding that's where all the books that I need for the new book are at and I can't get to them. But I also miss my local library, which I would go to at least once a week to pick up the bazillion books I put on hold. Yeah. And I miss going in there and I miss the smell of all the books and Okay, your next one. I'm getting weepy.
I am disliking the masks. Mm. So my mum made us some masks. They're very nice yep. masks. We also have some disposable masks. Not very breathable.
Not very breathable, no. But you're not going to go and say anything crazy about masks.
No, because absolutely not.
Not putting that on the podcast.
Oh, God.
Wearing the mask.
Or not going out. But
or just, yeah, exactly, stay inside.
Level of
yes, my, I must admit, my husband did say, mate, I did not realise how much my breath smelled. And I was like, that's what happens when you wear a mask.
That's the photo of Donald Trump, who had the mask only covering his mouth. Oh. And someone had written, like, you only had one job.
Yeah, that's it.
It's just cover the one job.
Just one job. Because this is a very safe space and you have opened up the pity party, Catherine, I will say that this is the last time I'm going to say it, but like a bazillion other writers this year, I must admit that I am missing not having real life things booked in for the book release. So I've got amazing, amazing things booked in and we'll tell you about them later for online things. But just like the going into the bookshop, the seeing all the people, the cuddles, and then all bustling out after, again, the squishiness. I'm clearly missing the squishiness
of being
squished up in a bar, drinks, laughs, et cetera.
But also the punchiness of those events, like great event, then you can either go home or have a little crew that you go and do something else. Like it's the perfect little setup thing.
And, you know, let's be perfectly frank. Also, the jumping on a plane and going away for a night in a hotel to do all those other things in another city, which feels like, who knows, may not happen for another how many years.
We're exactly going to be welcomed with open arms, are we?
No, I know. That writer from Melbourne, she's not welcome. Anyway, that's the end of my whinge. Any more on your whinge list?
The money I've spent on postage. Have you spent a lot of money on postage? My God. I'm searching for two things, a pair of runners that fit and a pair of tracksuit pants. And I refuse to keep them. I'm not compromising. I should just accept
this is good.
Doing a lot on return postage.
Are you going for the full like lounge suit in your tracksuit? Because I tell you what, Zoe Foster Blake has been rocking some very impressive.
I've seen a couple of people wearing some like equivalent of double denim, but for the COVID. No, maybe I should. Maybe that's where I'm going wrong.
Yeah, I think so. I think like go all out there. Just really rock it.
Embrace it.
Or something.
Watch this space, listeners.
That's going to be our feed next week. You in various. You know what you could do? Next time you get one, post a picture of it into our Twitter or on our Instagram and say, people, listen to me, tell me, should I send this back? Crowdsourcing.
We'll see.
Okay.
I've also ordered a lot of gluten-free pudding. This is a shout-out for people who are celiac or gluten-free. It's a regional Victorian company called King Valley Popcorn, and they are currently seeking a patent on their popcorn flour, but they have a gluten-free pudding that is made from popcorn flour that is gluten-free, and it is divine. It's really good. It's a pudding mix.
How many of these pudding mixes have you?
A lot. And they're expensive. But the postage is $17. Wow. 17. You have to buy a lot. Well, exactly.
You might as well buy in bulk then.
Yeah, I've been a lot of pudding, but I feel like that's been worthwhile.
Excellent. I'm so glad.
Are you out of pitiful things?
Yes, I'm done. Okay. I have no more pity.
Okay. My last one was I just really want to go swimming. In a pool. Wouldn't that be heaven?
That would be heaven. You know, actually, not to keep coming back to the word cave, but there was at least one person in the word cave who was ocean-based. That sounds very strange. I mean, she lived near the beach. She was not based in the ocean.
Yes. Part mermaid.
Is it actually
very water though? There's a moon-based story.
I feel like drunk. Yeah. Anyway, she had a swim every morning before she met with us, and like she just exuded that energy through the screen because she had been in the ocean in the morning. And I want that kind of swimming.
Do you meet you don't want that in the word cave, or are you in little subgroups?
No, no, no. You meet everyone.
How many people do it?
I think there were 14 in ours.
No,
13 or 14. That's very cool. So I hear you. Is swimming allowed or not allowed?
Not currently. No, it was open for a while. It's not in our area, but Paran pools, like a couple of kind of pools were open, but you had to book in, like the bookings open. It was like a obsessive thing. The booking opened it.
And I suppose
done by 8:50.
Yeah, I mean, if we're kind of worried about the air, the water, I feel like you don't want to be in a pool right now.
The chlorine, yeah.
Oh, that's true, chlorine.
Maybe the area around the pool, yeah.
Regardless, you want a swim and you should be allowed that want.
I like a swim. I really hate baths. Gross. Disgusting. Okay, but we can't finish on a negative note. No more doom and gloom. Do we have a sliver of positivity that you can think of?
I want to finish with positivity. I'm going to show you this. I showed you it before, but I'll just hold it up again so you can see.
Oh, I should take what's my camera?
I have a poster of my book. It's an actual full-grown poster. Like, again, this is like a grown-up thing. I never thought I'd have. I know, right? It's a poster. Did you get it? So yep. I have a poster because I have
of the mother fault.
Of the mother fault. And there's now events that you can book into. So first-time listeners, it would be a great honour if you would join us on the 2nd of September, which is actually my launch, like publication day, which is so exciting because that can sometimes be a day that falls a little flat, especially when you're in a lockdown, which I suspect we may still be.
Do something fun outside of, I don't even know.
Exactly. But I am going to be doing something fun because at 8:00 that night for readings, I'm going to be speaking with Charlotte Wood about the book. So that's very exciting. And you can book and it's free and it's a Zoom and you can come along.
That's the one I'm into.
Great. It's not quite up yet, but if you are not available that night or you would like to, or you're a Brisbaneite and you want to come to the AVID event, that event is the next week, I think Monday the 7th, and it is with Trent Dalton.
Look at you. Charlotte Wood, mm-hmm. Trent Dalton, who's next?
I know, right? Hold that. Friendly? Yeah, watch this space. Who knows? But it would be ace for first-time people to come along. You're very welcome. I would have been asking you to come along and meet me in a bookstore somewhere and tell me that you're a first-time listener, and maybe we'll do that another year.
So how are we going to negotiate the signed – what are people doing? Book plates? Is that what I've seen people doing?
Is that what they're doing? I don't know. Can you help me with this? I don't know.
Being that, I can't even remember where I saw a photo, but someone was signing book plates and maybe sending them to bookstores. So okay. Really sure.
I'll have to investigate this.
Investigate a thing, particularly COVID. I don't know.
They're not going to let me come to Booktopia, are they? And sign all the books. Oh. They're going to say, "You Melbourne writer, you stay right away." That's what I did it all for, Catherine. That's the whole reason that I wrote this book, to get to Booktopia and have a pile of books in front of me. Anyway, I have to write another book.
Hey, no, they can. You don't know what will happen.
Who knows? Who knows? Come on, people, stop the spread of COVID so I can go to Sydney and sign books.
Can I fully understand the etiquette? So if a bookshop hosts a book thing and it's a free thing, you buy from the bookshop the same way you would buy from.
That's what Chrissy Neen was telling us, that there's so much effort the bookstores go to host events. That they really need people, that they're really hoping that
people, which is what you do when you go anyway,
buy a book. Exactly. And you know what, if you have an idea of how I can personally sign people's books when you come to online events, please hit us up and tell us, because I am open to all ideas, you know, carrier pigeons, whatever.
I think Margaret front had a remote signing machine for a while, which sounded very new age. Like when she described it, I can't even remember where I heard her talk about this, but when she described it, it sounded like this amazing thing. It almost sounded like her hand came through the machine and signed your book. But I think it was essentially just like you hold your book there and it prints on top. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well,
stamp or something. Yeah, I don't know what you mean.
hit us up with your ideas, people, because I want to sign your books.
We have a postscript to the pity party.
One more fun and exciting.
Like a really exciting thing.
We have a very special guest who has volunteered to be an agony aunt of sorts for us here on the First Time podcast.
So we're putting a call out for questions to ask our like super incredibly awesome agony aunt, and each episode she will answer a question. So really what we're asking is, what would you ask if you had 5 minutes with a top tier awesome Australian author? How would you use that 5 minutes? And if the first thing that comes to your mind is that you would make a long-winded statement about yourself, that is not actually a question, don't bother sending it in. We've got that one covered.
You can reach out to us via Twitter or Instagram or via our website, and we want to hear all of your questions, and we will pick the best ones. The best ones, or just ones that amuse us?
I feel like the really juicy ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And potentially this amazing agony aunt will also have a hand in choosing which questions she wants to speak to, and look out in future episodes for when she arrives. Zana Freilon was born and now lives in Melbourne, but spent her early childhood in San Francisco. She has published 11 books, including picture books and novels for children. Her 2016 novel, The Bone Sparrow, won, well, everything. The Avia Book of the Year for Older Children, the Reading's Young Adult Book Prize, and the Amnesty Sillip Honour. It was also shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Awards, the Queensland Literary Awards, the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize, and the Gold Inky. The ones that disappeared won the New South Wales Prize for Fiction. Her latest novel for children is The Lost Soul Atlas. Zana Freilon, welcome to the First Time podcast in my humble little studio. This is the first time I'm doing a live recording in here.
This is amazing, and I will spend as much time as I can in your humble studio, Kate.
That's very wonderful. Very delightful to have you here. I have got rather a large number of questions, so I'm going to start at the beginning and just launch straight in. I want to know when you first saw your words in print, please.
I first saw my words in print, like you mean proper print.
Well, even as a kid at school, like school newsletter.
Okay. Going back that far was probably year two when I wrote a whole book about fairies, like a non-fiction informative text on fairies.
I love it. Do you still have it?
I do. I found it quite recently.
Oh my gosh, you have to send us a picture so I can put a picture on Instagram.
I will. And the lovely thing is there's a letter from my teacher that said, because, you know, this was back before there were computers in the classroom, that said something to the secretary about, can you please type this up? Because she spent so long writing it, we need to see it in proper print, which the secretary did. It was lovely.
Oh my goodness.
Thank you, office staff.
So there the hunger begins, grade two. Mm. The office staff type you up, and from there in, like it's just a burning desire.
Before that, I was making books like just forever, little picture books. I had one about a duck. I'll send photos of all of them. They were pretty funny.
I want them all.
Yeah.
Okay, so between grade two and your first books, two picture books, When No One Is Looking at the Zoo and On the Farm, which I did my research, were both published in 2009. How is that even possible?
They were both brought out at the same time.
That's 11 years ago. Tell us the story of how those books got published, please.
So I started writing the first one I wrote for someone else other than myself, and just the pure joy of writing, was in 2000 and or the year 2000 and 2001 when I moved to China for a year, and I was teaching English at a university over there, and I'd left my little sister behind, and we were very close. I'm 10 years older than my sister, and you know, I spent a lot of my childhood bringing her up and just spending time with her. So for me to leave her behind was, you know, tearing a piece of my heart out. And so I decided when I was over there I would write her a story and send it to her, and you know, we keep connected that way. So I wrote a book about a young female magician who solves crime using her knowledge of magic tricks, and I sent this to her.
Like in serialized fashion?
Well, it was really chapter by chapter.
Yeah.
And they were, I think I ended up writing like three of these books, you know, and they were They were a good 60,000 words each. I'll have to find them. I think they're pretty terrible. But that was...
Typing via email? How were you even doing this? Were you illustrating?
No. We had a computer. Yeah. And it was by email, I guess. Yeah.
You also need to find those, please. Dig them out.
I've got them somewhere. I mean, I'm sure they are terrible, really terrible. But anyway, so that was the first time I'd ever written for someone other than myself. And then it wasn't until I had kids that I was sort of writing picture books with them and for them. And a friend of mine saw something I'd written and said, oh, you should get that sent off. Send it off, see if you can get it published. And I sent it out and it got picked up.
So at this stage, were you part of any kind of writing world? Like when they said to you, you should send that out, where did you even begin to look?
Yeah, no, I wasn't part of any writing world at all. I mean, my uncle is quite a prolific author, Roland Perry. And he writes the most amazing amount of books. It's ridiculous. And he just churns them out. My mum had written a book when I was a teenager. So I knew about the world, but I certainly wasn't in it. I hadn't done a writing course. I hadn't done any writing stuff at uni. And so I think I probably said to my mum or my uncle, how do I send this out? And their advice was, phone them up, say you've got a book, do they want to see it? Which I would never do that now.
No. Now we know far better.
Yeah. But I had no idea. So I phoned up a whole lot of publishers and said, I've got this picture book manuscript. Do you want me to send it to you? And they all said yes.
So, you know, I think that this goes somewhere to saying that maybe the more we know we are, we also, it doesn't do us any service because then you know to be afraid. Absolutely. And you didn't know to be afraid.
No, I had no idea. I mean, I just looked up who's the head of, kids publishing it, and went, phoned them up and said, hi, this is, Zana Freilon. Can I talk to so-and-so? And they put me through.
Okay, so everyone wants to see it. Did you send it to everyone?
I mean, not everyone said. There were maybe three publishers. And they all said, yes, they'd love to see it.
And then what happened?
I think one didn't respond. One responded and said, it's really reliant on it being a flat book, which is how I'd seen it at that time. It turned out it didn't end up being a flat book. They did ask me if there was anything else I had, though, and were very, encouraging. And then Hardy Grant said, yeah, great, we love it. Have you got another one, which was at the zoo? And it sort of went from there.
Okay, so you've got these two picture books. You're suddenly going to become a published author. Mm. Did you already have other manuscripts and ideas you were working on? I know now because I have the joy and privilege of hanging out with you weekly that you always have projects on the go. So did you already have other projects sitting there?
Not really, because I hadn't actually, before someone said to me, you should send this to a publisher, I hadn't been thinking about writing in that way.
Yeah.
And so once it became a thing, then I started writing lots of picture books and, having lots of ideas and writing them down. But fairly quickly after I'd signed up with Hardy Grant Egmont, they said, have you got any, junior fiction or middle grade? And I went, give me a week and I'll get back to you. And I came back to them with, maybe six or seven fully formed ideas. And they said, we only needed one.
And so then did they select?
Then they said they liked the one that turned into Monstrum House, which was a four-book series for middle grade readers.
It really does say, like you're saying this like it's all very matter of fact, like that's just how it happened. But it does now have quite the magical kind of feel about it because you weren't expecting for it. You hadn't been sitting there doing draft after draft after manuscript, submitting it to a bazillion prizes. Mm. A lot of the stuff that people are doing right now just to get their foot in the door. Mm. Do you think the industry has really changed in that time or do you think you just...
I don't know, because I actually feel it's harder to get my stuff published now than it was then. So, it really was very matter of fact. It was just, they like my stuff, they're going to publish it. Great, this is a happy space. Whereas now, I've got a whole lot of manuscripts sitting on my computer, as you know, Kate, that no one wants to publish. So, I don't know, maybe it's the stuff I'm writing now, maybe it is that the industry's harder. There's just so much shelf space and a lot of stories to be told, I guess.
You now have an agent who is based in the UK. Mm. At what point did you get her on board?
So I was unagented until The Bone Sparrow, which the only reason, and I'd thought about getting an agent before then, and I'd asked people, and I got very conflicting advice.
As we all get and give.
exactly. And so after Monstrum House, I wrote sort of my first serious book, No Stars to Wish On, and that was picked up by Alan and Unwin, and they were lovely, and that was a really wonderful experience. But when I showed them Bone Sparrow, they weren't interested at all.
Aren't they regretting it?
And so after that, I thought with Bone Sparrow, I decided that this was the book that my kids were all at school by then. My youngest had just started prep, and I was giving myself that prep year to either make it as an author and make it work, otherwise I was going to go back into the classroom. So I was really, really desperate to get Bone Sparrow. And when Alan Unwin turned it down, I thought, okay, maybe this is when I look for an agent. And I sent it off to some other publishing houses who also turned it down. And I sent it to agents in Australia who also turned it down. And then I happened to be reading Rooftoppers by Catherine Rundell. And I always read the author's note at the back of books, especially books I love. And she mentioned Claire Wilson, her agent. And so I looked up Claire and it said she was open for submission. So I just emailed her and said, this is how I found you. I have a book. Do you want to take a look?
Okay. I can't believe I don't know this story, but this is why I interview you. I want to talk about the success of Bone Sparrow, because that to me seems ridiculous. No one wanted it here. The agents didn't want it here. And yet it went on to win like every award possible for children's lit. It's studied really widely in schools here and in the UK. It garnered you a bunch of success. What are the highs of the success of the Bone Sparrow, and okay, what have been the lows?
I mean, the highs are, it is so exciting to see people engaging with this material. I've had both kids and adults coming up and saying to me that, you know, they knew about refugees and asylum seekers, but they'd never really thought about it. And since reading my book, they're now full on, you know, fighting, backing the cause, doing stuff, raising funds, you know, volunteering for Asylum Seeker Resource Centre and all this sort of stuff, which is just wonderful and heartwarming and, you know, all the good things. It's also meant that, well, I signed a 2-book deal with Bone Sparrow, so that meant that I knew that I could go on and write at least one other book. And it's just really wonderful to have something that, you know, to have produced something that a whole lot of people are really enthusiastic about. It didn't give me the confidence I thought it would, which is funny.
Or in retrospect?
Probably at the time more than anything, although, yeah, I'm not sure. I always felt it was a fluke, you know, and I very much felt that it was probably the subject matter, you know, that was getting it the attention, which it certainly was, partly. And that's also great, but it didn't give me that confidence that, I'd made it as an author and a writer. The lows of it are that I also was very worried about being seen as an issues writer, which, you know, I'm still trying to escape from. Although this is also my fault, because I read articles and I go, how can this be happening in the world and people don't know about it? I know, I'll write a book about it.
As you're saying, you write what is in what you're reading, what's important to you. I mean, that's what everyone writes.
It's the burning thing, you know, and every one of the books, it's been, there is this thing which is burning and I have to find a way of getting this out of me, you know. And it's very much also when I write, it's an exploration of ideas and an exploration of themes and, I was about to say issues, just confirming what they said. You know, it's a way of working it out in my own head as much as anything else.
You're published both in the UK and in Australia and in other places as well, and with your UK-based agent. How do you make that'll work? Is the PR and the communications different in different territories, or do you just treat it all as the same kind of, this is my work?
It is different. So I've got my PR people in the UK and my PR people here. But because it's all, I mean, I'm with Hachette both in Australia and the UK, so it's all under the same umbrella company, which makes it easier, and they talk to each other. And Claire, my agent, also talks with the Australian Hachette as well. So I feel it's all sort of a big central base. I do often wish, though, that I had that human contact, as we all do, especially at the moment, you know, we're all missing out on it. But, you know, I would there are times when I just think I would love to sit down with my publishers in the UK and talk about this, or I'd love to sit down with Claire over a coffee and work out strategy or what we want to do next. I mean, it's great with Zoom and the internet and everything that we can have those conversations anyway, but I do miss that contact.
Do you think that is there a noticeable difference in the way that your readers in the UK and readers in Australia, for instance, respond to books, particularly like Bone Sparrow, which has got a very uniquely Australian kind of setting at the same time as being a very universal story? Is there a difference in the way that they're responding?
Certainly early on there was. So it took longer to take off here than it did in the UK. The UK were hugely enthusiastic right from the get-go. And it was interesting that it wasn't until a UK publishing house had signed up that the Australian houses then became interested and wanted it as well. And I think, you know, it's that strange thing of it's sometimes easier to look at issues that belong to a different country than it is to look at your own issues. Having said that, the take-up in schools now with Bone Sparrow has been quite large. So there are more and more schools contacting me saying it's on their list to do author talks and workshops and things. So it's beginning to get a look in here now. And I think it's also just an issue we're more open to now than possibly we were a few years ago.
One of the things I know about you is that you have an incredible work ethic. You've always, as I said, you've always got a lot of projects on the go, and you seem to be able to get words down rather quickly. What does your writing routine look like?
It's based around school times. So once the kids are at school, and I'm still doing the drop-off and pick-up, so I come home and I usually, you know, have a coffee and then head up to my studio space.
Which is the most divine. Can you describe it for us, please?
So the studio space used to be a climbing frame in the back of our garden, which my husband turned into a gorgeous little studio space. And it's got cork on the walls, which is one of my kids' ideas.
And which I have stolen here so that I can pin it's into so the walls. Useful. It's so useful.
It's great. So I can just pin anything on the walls. It's got my computer, a heater, because it gets very, very cold up there, and a whiteboard and sort of a few bookshelves with the books I need on hand.
And I know that you are like many writers, an explorer, a reader. You're always looking for threads that come from different places as well. Do you have a certain routine to doing reading, searching for inspiration, a certain number of words you have to get done? Like, what does it look like in the day?
No, it's I don't have a routine at all. And I've tried routines and they kind of haven't worked. I tend to use routines when I'm stuck. So if I'm having plot difficulty, then I'll go into a routine and I'll do, you know, 20-minute stints and I'll go to the library and I'll search for things. But really it's just sitting down and getting the words out. And one of the things I found, I read someone who said it recently, but it was something I'd already identified as well, that those days when, you know, when you pour the words out, and you come back the next day and you can't even remember writing them. You know, those beautiful, glorious, magical days that come along so infrequently, but they're like the drug, right? They're your hit that you keep going back for. And then there are those days where the words have to be dragged out of you and they're terrible and your fingers are fumbly on the keyboard and it's horrible. But when you go back and read them, it's almost impossible to tell the difference between the good day words and the bad day words. So when I figured that out, it's just like, I mean, either if I'm having a bad day, I go, forget it, I'm not going to do it today, and I'll go do all the other stuff that needs to be done around the house. Or I just pump something out and hope that it can be fixed later on.
When you have different projects on the go, do you have like a physical representation of them up on your walls? Do you have them in different folders? Do you have different notebooks? How are you navigating different projects on at the same time?
I do have different walls for different projects. So, you know, I've got all my junior fiction on my wall, my PhD stuff on another wall, my novel on this wall. And I've got different spaces in my notebooks for them. But other than that, they're all just there on the computer. The only thing is that my studio space is only for the creative work. So any research I do away from the studio space. So, and that includes rereading edits or proofreading or that kind of thing.
And what about your publicity things, all of that kind of stuff? You do that separately as well?
Separately, yeah. And it's whatever my husband used on the wood, to season the wood for the studio, there's this very strong smell. And as soon as I open that door and I breathe in those fumes, it gets me in the right headspace.
So that means, and I just want to put people in this, you live in a glorious part of the world, out near where I live. It's quite a trek up through a gorgeous garden to get to your little space. That means that you're not kind of just jumping out of the creative work and sending back an email to your publicist at the same time, all of those things. You're physically moving yourself to move the brain into that different spot.
Why
did I not know this, Sana? I'm sure you've told me this and I just haven't
probably,
actually.
I don't know when it would have come up, actually.
It seems so smart.
Well, it's also partly because if I stay up there too long, like I said, it's either really hot in summer or really cold in winter. So, as you know, as much as my body can take is probably as much, you know, creative work that can get done anyway.
Okay.
And it's away from the kettle and the coffee machine.
Yeah, which is important.
Yeah.
Which is important. I have just finished reading your incredible new book, The Lost Soul Atlas, this morning, and I sent you a message to say thanks for that weeping before breakfast. It's a wonder. It's the story of Twig and Flea, and also, okay, how do you pronounce the guardian's name?
What were you going to say, first of all?
Crook?
Yeah, that's pretty good. In my head, it's Crack. But, you know.
Okay. Who's a skeleton.
Skeleton raven.
A skeleton raven. I did have skeleton raven. Sorry, specifics. There's also a hoblin and some meeples and a bunch more extraordinary folk, but I'm going to leave them for the readers to discover. One of the characters, Flea, is a non-binary character. They tell Twig this in a really matter-of-fact way, and it's not commented on any further than that. Can you tell us about that decision with this character?
Yeah, so, and I have permission to talk about this, but my youngest is genderqueer. And she uses female pronouns. And it was amazing how when she was transitioning, there was nothing in any books that we could find. There were a few nonfiction things. There was quite a bit for young adults, but nothing for anyone her age group. And so I knew that one of the things I wanted to do was to have a genderqueer or non-binary character in my book. And I wanted it to be just normal. I did not want this to be what the book was about. It's just, you know, just as my youngest is a kid like any other kid, that's what I need the character to be.
And the thing that I noticed, and obviously I knew this about the book as I went into it, but the thing that I wanted to raise also for our listeners is that sometimes I've seen discussions that using they instead of specific pronouns is really hard for the writing, etc. It just is seamless in your work. So I think it's a really incredible example as well for writers who are looking, but how does this look on the page? Mm. It is just not an issue.
Well, it's not an issue. And it's interesting because it's also, it's what writers use anyway when you're referring to anyone whose gender is unknown. Mm. So, you know, early on when my youngest was trying to work out what her pronouns would be and she considered using they, them, and there are a few people who said, oh, that's too hard. But then we realise, you know, if you talk about someone broke into a house down the road and they took off with, you know, we use it already. They're already there in use. So, I think it's and the other thing is the more it's used, the easier it is for people to hear and to use as well.
If there are writers who are listening who are going, okay, I want to know more about that, but I don't even know where to begin, are there any places, resources that they should be looking at that are going to give them the right information, good information about?
I will find some and give them to you to link because I can't think of them off the top of my head. I mean, I used my sort of personal experience. But certainly a good place to start would be the Royal Tritton Hospital Gender Clinic, and they have very easy to access information, fact sheets, all that sort of stuff.
Brilliant. We will link to that and I will also add in any other links. In previous works, you've looked at lives of asylum seekers in detention. You've looked at child slavery. These are your issues-based things that you say you don't write about. In this book, Twig and Flea are homeless. They run with a group of other homeless youths, chased by the authorities at the whim always of those with power. Why this issue and why now?
So first of all, I hadn't decided to write this about this issue. I'd sort of flirted with it a bit through some other stuff I was writing, but it wasn't a burning thing because it was something people knew about. So I didn't feel it necessarily needed to have attention brought to it. And then I was driving through Templestowe on my way home from dropping the kids at school, and I had a very strong image of this scruffy kid holding out their hand to me and saying, "Come with me, I can show you how to fly."
You start me weeping again.
It was such a strong image, and it was such a sort of a bizarre thing to have popped into my head. And I have one of those things where I don't know how I got home because, you know, the last thing I remembered was sitting in the traffic in Templestowe, and then I was pulling up at my house and I thought, that's lucky I...
Oops, it is. Yeah. Sometimes how writers operate.
Exactly, exactly. And so that image stayed with me. And there was also an image which I had in my studio, which was of... it was actually a cover for Bone Sparrow that an illustrator had sent for the American version. And it hadn't been chosen, but it was my favourite. And it was of a kid that had sort of half-drawn wings on his back, like sort of shimmery wings on his back, and he was leaping up from one rock to another. And in my head, I always saw that as leaping from a cemetery gravestone. And so then those two images combined, and I went, okay, I've got to do something here. So I started looking at... you know, I just started exploring what these kids could be doing, who they could be, as, you know, you do when you get an idea. And I came across an article in The Guardian about a group of homeless children who had, they used to go to the big dump site in the middle of the city because it got them away from the police and away from gangs and, you know, it was their safe space. Until one day the police had come along and run them off the edge of the cliff and into this raging river below. Those who survived were sprayed with tear gas, so they drowned. And it was this absolutely horrific event, and it was in 2016. And it was one of those things where I just thought, how have we not, one, heard about this? How are we not up in arms about it? Mm. You know, kids, they don't have a voice. People don't listen to them. And so then once I saw that, it all sort of came together. And I knew that I wanted that to be the setting, but not necessarily, I didn't want to make it an issues book, and I was really firm that I didn't want to make an issues book, but I did still want to be talking about these things because it is important. And it's also that idea of, you know, there being kids growing up, and these are sort of the kids I worked with when I was an integration aide in schools, growing up knowing that they do not have a voice and that what they say doesn't matter and that people are not going to listen to them. Mm. And I wanted to write something which showed those kids that it does matter and they do have a voice. So that was really important.
I'm going to jump ahead because I wanted to talk to you about that. There's a lot of talk at the moment about prescient books, books that are right and ripe for right now. And when I was reading your book, so many lines jumped off the page. One of them was this: and suddenly I understand that there is always something you can do. It's just a matter of choosing whether or not to do it. Not doing it is just as big a choice as doing. We're talking in a week where thousands of teens have pranked Trump on TikTok during Black Lives Matter protests, at a time when Greta Thunberg and the school strike for climate is all going on. As adults, how do you think we best support the young people in our lives who do feel like they don't have a voice, who are inheriting our stupid mess, but who are already trying to fight hard to get their voice heard? How do we support them best?
I wish I knew. I think it's all a matter of encouraging and saying, yes, that this is right. You do have a voice. And that, I mean, that is such a strong message for kids to know that they have power, and they do have a voice, and that the change they demand does happen. And I think, I mean, they're at a pretty great time at the moment where they're actually seeing that what they are doing and the ways they are protesting are getting noticed and they are getting talked about. And TikTok and Trump, I mean, that has to be one of the greatest moments in history, right?
Totally does. I want someone to write a book about that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, when the kids say they want to take a day off school to go on a climate strike, great, do it. You know, it's that reinforcing of their voices and doing everything we can as adults to show them that what they say does matter and what they believe matters.
Can you please tell us about Stardust?
Yes, I can. So this is funny because apparently I'm not the first person to have, you know, discovered this wonderful thing about Stardust, that it sits on our rooftops. Kate, there is Stardust on our rooftops and there is Stardust in us. And, you know, that the same stars that exploded to make this universe is inside us, which blew my mind. Apparently it's blown many minds before mine.
It's the most extraordinary metaphor. So, you know, it makes sense that it makes its way to people. But you also found out about it and discovered more about it in some museum somewhere, because you're always in museums and libraries.
Museums. I think if I wasn't an author or in a classroom, I would be a museum curator.
Excellent. So heads good. Up to the museums out yeah. there who are looking for an author/curator.
Yes, there had to be a job. Right?
Surely.
Yeah. So we were in a museum in Scotland and there was this marvellous sort of multimedia exhibit that had, it was talking about deep time, and it had this whole thing about the stars that made the universe and how they're in us and on our rooftops and everything. It was just, I sat there watching it over and over again and going, yes, this is exactly what my book's about. This has to be part of it. This is really important.
So were those ideas that at that stage you were already writing your book?
Mm.
I want to know those delicious kinds of ideas that you have and that you weave in, are they things that you've collected and popped in your writerly pocket, you know, along during your life?
Yeah.
Or do they just come up at that time for that project? They kind of raise their head and you just sink it straight in?
It depends. This book, I was thinking on my way here, is more than any other book. It's got so much of me in it. Because when I started writing it, you know, and I said that I didn't want to be an issues book, but I did want to write about these kids. So it was really hard to find a way to do that. And I struggled with it for quite a while, as you'll remember, Kate.
I do.
And then the way I got through that was by saying, okay, I'm going to write down everything I love, you know, everything I'm passionate about, everything I believe, all the true things to me. And I wrote them down on a big bit of paper and went, how do these fit together? How can I put them in there? So it's very much, you know, a passion project sounds wrong, but, you know, it's got all my passions in there. So, yes, I collect them and put them in my authorly pocket, but also it was just, this is something that I just love, so I'm going to write about it, and that's what will bring the magic to the book. And it did, and it made it, you know, when I had the amazing insight that I had to make it more folkloric, that was what really twisted it over the edge from being an issues book to being sort of an adventure, not fantasy either, but, you know, it's got those fantastical elements to it, which make it more of an adventure story
And such an adventure story. Like, I honestly, I thought I'm going to have to take the kids late to school today because I am actually just not going to stop reading. I must continue reading and find out what happens here, even though I knew what happens because you've told me already. You said then about how you have struggled with this project, and I'm in the privileged position of knowing this because we talk about it all the time. Seeing it now so sparkling and wonderful and out in the world, and you know, even though I know you so well, I can't see a hint of that that fear or that doubt in the book. You've given us one strategy about how you kind of practically worked through that. How do you work through those struggles emotionally when you're like, nah, this is rubbish and it's never going to be any good?
Well, one thing which Kate knows but listeners don't is that in the middle of editing sort of a fairly early draft, our heaters were poisoning us. So I was suffering from quite severe carbon monoxide poisoning. And I didn't like the book much then.
No, not at all. Let this be our community service announcement to get your heaters checked.
Please check your heaters. So that was, it was of all the books, and possibly because of that, but maybe just because the book it was as well, it was the one I struggled with the most. And it got to the point where I sat down at the computer to send a letter to my publishers to say, I'm very sorry, here is your advance back. I can't make this work. I'm going to have to start again on something, or, you know, throw in the towel with this whole writing business because it's just not working. And I sat down to do it and I went, okay, I'll give it one more try. And if I can't make myself like it, because I hated it, I absolutely hated it. You know,
I remember you hating it.
I could not look at it. And this had come from loving it. You know, I'd said when I wrote the first draft, it was very much a close the door, just write what I love. And that was so much fun. That was 2 or 3 months of the most fun I've ever had writing. And I loved every second of it. You know, I'd wake up desperate to get back to the computer to write the next bit and spend time with the characters. So when I finished that first draft, I was really sad that I wouldn't actually be able to have more adventures with the characters and spend more time with them. So to go from loving the characters more than I've ever loved characters I've written before to hating the whole project and the whole book and never wanting to see it again, it was quite a massive swing. And so I sat down and I wasn't in my studio. I was downstairs. And I remember sitting on the carpet and just going, today's the day I either make it work and I make myself love it again or I'm going to pull it, because I couldn't stand the thought of going around to bookshops and saying, do you want me to sign this book and ask you to sell something I really hate? So, and I knew I couldn't wing it either. So I sat down with a post-it paper and I've got, I can't even send you the photo of it because it gives away too many.
No spoilers.
But I wrote down everything that was working, everything that wasn't working, and I sort of mapped it out. And I spent the day, I then had a few ideas that I shot off to one of the most wonderful booksellers in the world, Danny Solomon at Readings Kids, and I said, what do you think? And she wrote back, and, you know, we had this back and forth, and she was working, poor thing. You know, she's trying to get her work done, and I'm saying, help me. And we had this back and forth throughout the day, and by the end of the day I went, yep, I can make this work.
I'm so glad that that happened. You described maps a couple of times there, or used the word maps, and maps is obviously something that you love and it's something intrinsic to this book as well. You've said before that you don't necessarily plot, but you do this kind of bigger picture framing of the whole thing.
Yeah, I tend to have, in fact, I was listening to, I know I can't think who it was that said the tent pics. You did an interview with someone.
Oh, yes. I can't remember
who
it was either.
Early episodes, but they talked about tent pics, and that's sort of what it's like. It's a bit like I have maybe 10 images in my head of where the story's going, and that's what I work to. But I find plotting quite difficult. For this one, when I really had no idea how I would fix it, and this was before I'd brought in the afterlife element, I sat down with post-it notes and I did the whole writing it out, sticking it on the window, and that was brilliant. And that gave me the afterlife section, which I think, again, really lifted it into that adventure story.
And it is quite, I mean, in that sense, I'm sure people look and will be amazed that you haven't plotted it, because it is quite intricate structurally and really does need to work on certain beats of getting to the right point at the right time and together. So that makes sense that you had to do it that way. Was there a lot of movement in the editing process of getting those dual strands of the story aligned?
Not really. I mean, I wrote the real world section first and then I wrote the afterlife section. The hardest thing, I guess, was getting them to feel close enough that the afterlife section, the real life section, were really properly intertwined. And that took some fiddling, but I really enjoyed that. That was like an editorial problem that just needed solving. You know, it was a challenge.
Well, and the book revolves around riddles and tricks and challenges as well. And so that idea, I couldn't even help reading some of the riddles out to my kids this morning while I was reading, because they're so delicious. But you can feel the joy that you've had as the author in putting those in and inviting the reader in as well. Is part of that about having a really active reader?
Oh, absolutely. And I was really, I mean, I remember as a kid reading books where, especially sort of crime books, I'm trying to think which one was the best one. It wasn't Nancy Drew. That was one I used to love. But those books where there's something happened, a mystery's happened, but there's no way of the reader working it out for themselves would frustrate me beyond belief. So it was really important for me that whatever I do, there has to be hints along the way that readers can pick up on. And, you know, even if you don't pick up on it, it doesn't matter. You still find out what happens. But that idea that anything that gets solved has to be able to be solved by the reader as well. It's really important.
Such a satisfying payoff for the reader. Aside from that extraordinary respect with which I think you hold your young readers by exploring the kind of complicated issues that you do, one of the standout features of your work, and I'm not the only one to say this, is what you do with language and with words on the line. So I'm going to ask if you can please just read a little piece from The Lost Soul Atlas, which I've chosen for you. So,
where do you really go when you go out at night? Why can't you tell me? I did tell you. I go to heaven. I follow the gargoyles. You have to wait for a gargoyle moon, of course. But if you wait and watch, you'll see them crack free from their rock skin, called out by the moon. They dance and spin and hunt in the moonlight. And if you're not careful, you'll get caught up in their dance and you might just end up a gargoyle yourself. But, and Dar leans in close, his hands weaving the air in front of him, if you're clever and careful, if you're mouse quiet and fox clever, you can follow them. They know all the ins and outs between the worlds.
Thank you. It's so wonderful. What is your philosophy of language?
My philosophy of language?
Yeah.
To play with it and to use it in any way that feels right. So I'm very big on making up words, and this is possibly partly because I'm always mixing up words. So I'll just say things when I'm talking to my family and they'll invariably say, that's not a word. It's like, totally is a word. Or, that's
who
not
cares?
That's not a
it's
word.
Totally yeah. Making my point.
Exactly. So I love language. I love the oral qualities of language. I love the way words feel on your tongue and the way they feel in the air. Like, it's just everything about them excites me, really.
Do you collect words?
No, I tried for a time. I had like a box of words I collected and then, no, I didn't do it.
This is very amusing. We just had to stop the interview there because I had someone come and deliver something and that looked like it needed to be signed for. And would you believe it is? And I can see because it's been awfully banged up in the post. It is a new copy of Zina Freeland's new book, The Lost Soul Atlas, which is just one of the spooky, miraculous things that would happen when I'm talking to someone like you, because things around you are so very magical. Tell me, Zina, who are your influences in the writing world? Who are you reading to get this extraordinary kind of language in your books?
I think the language comes from my sort of early reading experiences. So, you know, when we were growing up, there wasn't really a YA section. There was a teen section that had very few books in it, but we had at my house, we had this wonderful library, which was just a room full of books and comfy chairs. And I would just go and raid those shelves whenever I could. And my mum put me on to Isabel Allende when I was about 13, 14, and I absolutely fell in love with her and her writing and the magical realism and the way she uses language. It's so musical. So I think she's had a really big influence on the way I write. And then from there, I've just, you know, I'm a very big reader, so I read anything and everything. But there are so many brilliant authors out there. You know, I'm thinking Max Porter and I've now drawn a mind blank of all the ones.
Max Porter and, like, there's so much synergy, I think, between Lanny and this book. You know,
I'm
like, they
so glad you said
they
that.
Can
that's
kind
so
of
exciting.
Sit together, and I think that that's I think one of the things about it, it's obviously it's a book for older readers ostensibly, but I've been saying when I've been talking about it, also for adults with impeccable taste, because it is, you can read those two books together and the layers that you've got in there as well, the adventure story and the riddles and then the thematic stuff, just make it such a feast. You're really active in the Auslit scene. You ran a couple of years back the Authors for Asylum Seekers Twitter auction and then participated in Authors for Fires, which was based on that. You endorse books, you sit on judging panels. What do you reckon are the keys to being a good or an active member of a book community?
First of all, the YA community is such a wonderful community to be part of. It's so, and also, you know, and children's authors and just authors in general, I've never had I've never had a moment with authors here or in the UK either where I have felt anything other than just supported. And it's such a gorgeous community to be part of. And that includes the authors as well as the publishers and the booksellers and everyone. So when I'm endorsing and being active, it's very true. It's not like I feel that everyone has to do it or everyone should be doing it. It's because I want to be part of it. And it's such a, it's just a wonderful relationship, really. It is that thing about supporting each other. So if I'm, and I know that you have this same philosophy as well, if I read a book that I don't like, I just don't mention it. I certainly don't get online and say all the bad things about it or what I didn't like about it. But when I read something that I do like and I love, then I'm sure to promote it. And, you know, I've got maybe 200 followers. So so it's not like anything I say.
Give her more followers, everyone, and then yeah, she'll have on. To read more.
But it's all very genuine. And I think that's the main thing, is that you're genuine and you're supportive and generous as well. You know, the more generous you are with your time towards other people and making other people feel connected.
You do a lot of school visits, both kind of online school visits when you're doing UK stuff and here in Australia. You have started recently framing your author talks in a kind of a different way than a lot of authors do it. Can you tell us a little bit about the student-led author conversations that you've been doing?
Yeah, so this all started with my son was an Inkies judge, and Inkies is one of the most wonderful things, and it looks like it may be finishing, and it
fund breaks the Inkies.
My heart. So yes, please, please fund the Inkies. But he was a judge a few years back, and one of the things they got to do was to interview authors at festivals. There was a very funny interview where I was one of the shortlisted books for the Inkies, so my son was interviewing me along with a whole lot of other people. But it was great because the kids came up with the best questions. I mean, this was like no other interview I'd ever had. And I watched all of them do their stuff with all the authors, and they were just fantastic. You know, they were discussing things and finding little points and talking points that everyone else had missed. And it was...
And not afraid to ask the big questions, I recall. Ask.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So it was joyous and it was exciting. So when I do school visits now, the thing I always say is, and the thing I always recommend, is to have student moderators leading the Q&A session. And it makes for the best school visits because the kids are more engaged because they've got their peers up on stage with me. The questions are ones which often I've never heard before, so my answers are always really genuine and true, and not something which, you know, when you have quite a few of these interviews, you find yourself saying the same thing, yeah, almost on, you know, playback.
And also you can often get caught, and I'm sure that other authors who do school visits will have this feeling, you get caught in that Q&A session where, you know, teachers are like elbowing kids in the back and the kids are all asking the same question, which, yep, is for the assignment or,
yeah,
whatever.
Exactly.
Like, this is,
yep,
such an incredible way just to avoid that altogether and have fun with it.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is it's about giving kids a voice and respecting that kids know what they're talking about and they are wonderful thinkers and they think in ways which, you know, we forget as adults. So, yeah, I love it.
Another one of the things with respect for children is this book, Sana, is scary. Like, it's scary. The Hobbling is scary. The librarians are really, really scary. How much can kids handle, and is it generally more than we think?
It is so much more than we think. And, I mean, the thing which is, you know, it's again, nothing new, but books are the safest place for kids to explore emotions, especially things that might be scary or sad or whatever, because you can close the book. You know it's not real. You can turn away from it. You can say it's too much. And I've done that with books. There are books where I've said this is too much of it. In fact, one of them was Grief is a Thing with Feathers by Max Porter. And I feel I have to go back and read it. But when I read it, it had such a wonderfully emotional response that I couldn't read it at that time. And I went, that's okay, I can come back to this. So kids do that too, and they do it all the time. And I think with things that are scary, as the wonderful Neil Gaiman said when he'd written Coraline, which is perhaps the
so
most terrifying book ever.
Terrifying.
He said, you know, kids have to know that there are monsters in the world. And if they can see, I'm completely slaughtering what he said,
that's
but
okay.
It was something
he
along those
mind.
Lines that, you know, if you can meet monsters in books than when you meet monsters in the real world. You'll be prepared. That was sort of the basic idea.
You're currently working on a secret collaborative project with one of your favourite authors. So without naming names or giving too much away, I just wanted to ask you how that came about, because it's not an agent or publisher-led project. It happened quite organically, and I think that people would find inspiration in just being able to reach out to someone you really admire and see if they want to work with you.
Well, I think I probably can say, because she said in an interview.
Oh, great. Excellent. Okay, let's talk about it.
So I'm working on a collaborative project with the wonderful Bren McDibble, who I have loved her work, and our books, funnily enough, were often on, you know, shortlists next
together
to each other.
Yeah.
And I sort of didn't really think she would even potentially know me, but we both followed each other on Twitter. And there was something that someone had called out for. I can't remember what it was. It might have even been me. I did a call out for, like, you know, answer this. It was something like answer this question. It was something to do with, I remember getting, there was a plot problem I had, and I was asking Siri the question to get the answer back.
Always ask Twitter.
Oh, well, I know. Siri had a few good ideas. But so then I sent it out to Twitter, and Bren came back with a great answer. And I said something like, oh, that's so perfect. It fits in perfectly. And she wrote back something, and I said, maybe we should write a book together. And then she direct messaged me and said, that's a really great idea. I'd love to do it. Were you being serious? And I said, oh, my God, yes. And that's what happened. It was brilliant.
So just tell us, just briefly tell us about how is that working? You're obviously not sitting together writing anything.
We've never met each other.
I love this so much.
I don't even know what she looks like, right?
So how are you doing it? How are you doing the writing?
We are conversing over Twitter, which is very strange because, as you know, I'm very on social media. I keep saying things like, when people at me, and I have my sister say, that's not a thing, at someone. So we've been talking over Twitter, and that was how we plotted the whole book, was a back and forth, this really furious conversation we had. We were both messaging each other at the same time with these amazing ideas and really just working off each other. And then it's told from two different perspectives. So Bren went off, wrote her perspective, I went off and wrote mine, and now we've come together and have been emailing each other. Bren loves Scrivener, which I do not, but I'm doing my bit for this book, and I'm trying to learn Scrivener, which does not work if it's not a Mac. So Scrivener people, get your act together, please.
I'm so excited for what this project is, but I'm also really excited, and I put the challenge out to our listeners to reach out to someone that you want to work with on Twitter, yeah, because it was so inspiring hearing how that happened. We're all sitting around going, what do you mean? You've got a collaborative project. What are
it
you
was
doing?
Really strange, yeah.
But that's how these things work. And that's also the magic when we're talking about, you know, social media, it's such a drag, and it's a drag having to do all the things and get on it. Like, this is the magic of it too. Yeah. This is those kind of opportunities. You're doing something else new this year because you are doing your PhD.
I am.
Tell us, I know we will speak for like an hour if we start talking about what your PhD is about. So I just want to know a little bit about how the process is different for you diving into a new project via the kind of framework of a PhD.
Well, interestingly, one of the things which, you know, when you're talking about routine before, one of the things which I've put into my PhD routine is to read for however long. It sort of all went up in the air with lockdown. I couldn't stick to it anymore. But I gave myself between 45 minutes and an hour to read whatever I wanted. And that was one of my supervisors said, just go out and read the things you love. And it's like, yes, okay, this is like my job. I can be doing this. So
so validating.
It's so validating. And it's so, you know, we should be doing this as authors. We should be saying, I'm reading, this is actually work. But we don't, because it's so joyous that it's, you know, doesn't feel like work. But I know there was a wonderful author in one of the writing books that says that, you know, she sets time aside to read every day because that's part of her job. So that's probably the biggest thing is having that structure there. And also, you know, for all my books, I do a lot of research. But the research for this is different because it's academic texts, and it's getting back into that academic world, which really excites me. So it's been wonderful fun.
I'm so excited to see what comes out of that as well. At the same time, you've got, and this is one of the things that hanging out with picture book writers and creators has been so odd to me, because you've got a new picture book coming out this year that I think you'd written before I even met you. Mm. There's a different time frame that happens with picture books.
Very slow.
What's your next picture book?
So my next picture book, it was meant to be coming out this year. It's now moved to 2021. And it's called The Curiosities. And I wrote it, I wrote it the same time that I wrote Wisp, which is already out in the world. And I wrote it about, I sort of actually wrote it as a response to one of my kids getting a diagnosis for Tourette's syndrome. And it was a way of exploring, you know, what does this mean? How is it going to affect my kid? And it was, what it turned into was a book about kids being individuals and kids being different and just everyone being different, really, you know, kids being individual. And so you can read it at any level. You can read it as a book about disability. You can read a book about mental health. You can read it just as a book about a kid who gets visited by these strange creatures called curiosities. So
I love it.
I'm really excited for that to come out.
Do you think that in your career, as you kind of look forward at it, that you will just continue to have a range of picture books of projects in different forms? Is that the way that you see it rolling out?
I hope so. I really enjoy exploring the different forms. I love picture book writing, and I've got a whole lot of picture books that, you know, may never see the light of day. But the collaboration you get with when you've got two artists working together is just so exciting. And I very much see picture books as real collaborations. So when I wrote Wisp, the illustrator Graham, who lives in the UK, and again, you know, I've never met him, but we speak a lot online, and he's just the most wonderful, wonderful human being. And he said to me, you know, at first the publisher kept us apart. She wouldn't let us even email. We didn't get each other's emails or anything, which is really interesting. And I said, she said, do you want me to tell Graham anything? And I said, no, it's just, this is as much his project as it is mine. Mm. I want to see what he makes from the words and what comes up with it. And it was just wonderful. So, yeah, I love that.
What advice can you offer other writers, either who are freshly coming out with new books in the world at the moment or who are navigating the middle of the career like you are?
Mm.
What advice can you offer them?
I don't know I'm in a position to give advice, Kate. Enjoy the highs, because I know that certainly with Bone Sparrow, I was so worried about people discovering that I'm a fraud that I didn't enjoy it at all. And then, of course, you miss it when there's no attention being paid and no one's saying, my God, this book is great. You know, can you sign a copy? It's like, well, why aren't people coming up to me? You know, so enjoy the highs when they come. Enjoy the writing. I think for me, what I discovered with Lost Soul Atlas was to completely close the door for the first draft. So to absolutely just write what I wanted to write and to imagine that no one was ever going to read it. And that way I could say what I really wanted to say. And then, of course, when you edit, you can take out all the bits you don't want anyone to know. But that made a really big difference for me. And also to let the book become what it wants to become. So that idea of, you know, does it want to be a folktale? Make it a folktale. Make it more, you know, really, really push it into being what it wants to become. And also knowing that, who was it that said you got to pin the butterfly? Anne Patchett. That's right. And she said, you have to pin your butterfly. So, you know, as authors, we have these wonderful ideas of what our project's going to be, our next book is going to be the best thing ever. And when you write it down, it's like you've taken this butterfly and you've stuck it onto a piece of cardboard and, you know, driven pins through it. And what you're left with is this bloodied mess on the page. And you just have to accept it and go with it.
Thank you so much for leaving us with that incredible image. Zana, can you please recommend us a debut book, any time, any genre?
Well, this was really hard. So I knew I had to answer this question. And how can you say one?
I know. Okay. People generally get away with two if you want to.
That's good. I'm going
to
go an adult and a kid's book. Great. So the adult is The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini, which I just love for so many reasons. And I could not believe that, you know, he'd never written anything before that. It's a marvellous, marvellous book. Again, one that, you know, talks about, doesn't talk about, that uses language so beautifully. Mm. And the other one is Black Cockatoo by Carl Merrison, which it's a book brought out by Magabala Books. And I first came across it when I was judging the Readings Kids Prize. And I was in the car. It was quite a long car trip and I read it. And then I stopped and I went back to the beginning and I read it again. And I ended up reading it 3 or 4 times because it's one of those books that is so beautifully, quietly powerful that you just have to read it again. Like it's quite remarkable, and I can't even put my finger on what it is about it that makes it so wonderful. But it's really it's just that there's this quiet power to it, which is so beautiful.
Well, we shall take your word for it, and everyone can go out and buy a copy. Thank you so much for talking to
me
in my little studio.
Anytime. It's been joyous as always.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.